Aubrey in the flightless vessels around him, while up above, the only vessel ever to be resurrected from the graveyard carries 169 souls into the sky. 169 souls with no possible way to land. 69. Lev. Lev has the advantage of being behind the action. He can see where the battlefront is. He can see the tactics of the Juvie attack force. And since no one has yet to graft eyes in the back of their head, Lev can move behind the battle without being caught. And so can Nelson. It's before the escape jet is taxied away, when the focus is still on the armed AWOLs toward the north end of the main aisle. Lev spots Nelson leaving his van at the far western aisles of the graveyard and moving in on foot. The parts pirate now wears a Juvie uniform he must have pulled from a real Juvie that he tranked. He'll blend in. He'll pass for one of them. The only thing Lev can pass for is an AWOL, and that won't get him anything but unconscious. He knows he has to be careful. Lev tries to figure out where Connor might be in this war zone, and suddenly he realizes that he doesn't even know this Connor. The old Connor was all about saving himself, and he was good at it. But will he still be that way now that he's responsible for every kid here? Connor saved a baby once. He also saved Lev. No, he won't be running or hiding. He'll be here until the last AWOL is taken down, and that last one may very well be him. Nelson doesn't know that. He sees Connor in only one dimension, a lowly AWOL. He won't look for Connor at the battlefront, he'll look for him on the fringes. And sure enough, Lev sees Nelson on the edges, places where stray kids have been tranked. Like a vulture pecking at carrion, Nelson lifts their heads off the ground, looks at each of their faces, then drops them back down again, moving on to the next one. Lev circles behind Nelson in shadows, giving him a wide berth, and makes his way closer to the danger zone where riot police clash with armed AWOLs. This is where Connor will be. But how can Lev save him from both Nelson and the Juvies? When the answer comes to Lev, he grins in spite of the dire battle around him. The answer is simple. It's terrifying. It's impossible. It might work. Lev nears the main aisle just as the Dreamliner begins to move, and riot police advance on the crush of kids who never made it on board. 100 yards away, on the failed front line, Lev sees a figure in off-color camouflage fearlessly charge a Juvie shooting at him. The kid takes the Juvie out, not with a bullet, but with the butt of his rifle, and there's something about the way this kid moves that's familiar. Lev charges against a panic of escaping kids running toward him, ignoring the sound of gunfire, the roar of jet engines, and the crunch of crushing metal as the Dreamliner takes out a riot truck on takeoff. The tumbling truck bursts into flames as the plane rises into the sky, and the light of the explosion illuminates the face of the kid in camouflage. Lev knows he's found him.
Connor!
But Connor's eyes are fixed on the escaping plane.
Don't just stand there. Run!
Connor tells him.
You were all supposed to run!
Connor, it's me. It's Lev.
Even when Connor looks at Lev, he doesn't seem to recognize him at first, and Lev knows it's more than just the hair. Neither of them are the kids they were a year ago.
Lev, what are you doing here? What, has the whole world gone nuts and I've lost my mind?
I'm sure both are true, but I'm really here.
Lev bends down and takes the trank gun away from the cop Connor has just rendered unconscious.
I came to save you.
That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
That's probably true, too, but I have to warn you, there's a parts pirate after you.
That's the least of my problems right now.
Another kid with an automatic rifle hurries up to Connor.
We're out of ammunition! What do we do?
Sticks and stones and airplane parts, Connor tells him.
Or you can take your chances and run. Starkey didn't leave us many choices.
Freaking Starkey!
The kid drops his spent weapon.
Good luck, Connor.
He says, and hurries away, trying to lose himself in the night. Farther away, the mob that has been trying to get on the Dreamliner is now lit by the spotlight of a police helicopter and is fully surrounded. There are maybe 400 kids corralled and helpless, while huge transport trucks roll down the main aisle to gather them and take them away.
There's nothing you can do for him now, Lev tells Connor.
I won't leave them.
That's why I'm not giving you a choice.
Then Lev raises the trank pistol he took from the unconscious Juvie and shoots Connor in the arm. Connor spun away by the force of the blast and goes down, the tranks taking effect in seconds. Lev catches him as he falls, and he looks up at Lev with half-open, fading eyes.
It didn't work, Lev, he says weakly. My plan didn't work.
I know,
Lev tells him as Connor slips from consciousness.
But maybe mine will.
70. Nelson.
He has no idea how many kids are here, how deep the airplane graveyard goes, or where his target might be in the midst of the chaos. No matter. If the Juvies do their job, and it looks like they will, the whole nest of AWOLs will be rounded up, tranked, and yanked. Lassiter will be among them. Nelson just needs to keep his eyes open and his head low. Because some of these kids have weapons, and by the sound of them, they're deadly. Methodically, he checks the AWOLs who have already been tranked, and takes down a few himself, just so he really looks like a Juvie cop doing his job. He keeps a safe distance from the heart of the battle, knowing that the Akron AWOL will do the same. One of the Juvie cops spots him looking at the faces of the fallen AWOLs.
Don't waste your time, he says. It's our asses if any of these kids get past us and into the desert.
I'm looking for an AWOL neighbor kid, Nelson tells him without missing a beat. Favor for the wife.
But the cop is suspicious.
Do I know you? What unit are you with?
Unit 16 down from Phoenix.
There is no Unit 16 in Phoenix.
Deciding this has gone quite far enough, Nelson tranks him, then tranks an escaping AWOL who saw him do it, then gets back to the task of finding the Akron AWOL. It's only when he sees the Dreamliner taking off that he begins to worry. What are the chances that Lassiter's on that plane? Then he realizes that the riot squad isn't just tranking and yanking, they're going against procedure, loading the mob into the transport trucks conscious. If Lassiter gets loaded into a truck before Nelson can get to him, it's over. Now he's worried. He moves closer to the riot roundup, pulling out binoculars, scanning the faces. A gaggle of scared teenagers. No Lassiter. Sure, he might be in the swarm, but if he is, Nelson can't spot him. He puts down the binoculars.
Crap!
He knows that with every passing second, his chances get slimmer. Around him, kids who are either too slow to get there or smart enough to stay away from the corralled mob race in all directions to escape. Some get tranked as they run, but the farther they are away from the main action, the better their chances. Up ahead, Nelson sees the dark silhouette of one smaller kid struggling to carry an older tranked kid on his back, reminding Nelson of the way ants will carry off their wounded. But apparently this kid has better sense than an ant, because he gives up, drops the bigger kid in the dust, and takes off into the shadows. Nelson almost doesn't check the dropped kid. He almost walks on past, because he doesn't want to miss a single face running by. But Nelson is nothing if not thorough. He grabs the unconscious kid by the hair, lifts his head out of the dirt, and practically yells with triumphant surprise. It's him. It's Lassiter. Brought to him like a gift, right in his path. Nelson wastes no time. He hefts him onto his back, gets his bearings, and weaves through the aircraft, heading toward his waiting van. As he crosses an outer aisle, he's spotted by another Juvie.
Forget him, the cop says. Leave him for sanitation and transport. Our orders are to take out the bolters.
And to emphasize his point, he fires at a girl bolting between two fighter jets, tranking her into the dust.
Special orders on this one.
Nelson tells him, trying to get past, but the other cop won't yield.
Why? Is he the one who's been starting the fires in town?
Yeah, Nelson says. He's the one.
Then behind them, three kids try to break for the outer aisles, and their attempted escape pulls the cop's attention long enough for Nelson to get past him. The farther from the main aisle, the fewer AWOLs and the fewer cops. Transport trucks are already here on the outskirts, gathering whatever tranked kids they find before moving into the high-density zone. The San and Tran workers treat the fallen kids with much more care than the Juvies, zipping them into padded transport bags. K-9 constrictive sleeping bags in either powder blue or pink that cover everything but their faces so that their precious parts are protected in transit. Nelson reaches his van, dumps Connor in the back, and drives out the way he came, heading toward the north gate, knowing he's not in the clear yet. As he nears the gate, there's a small showing of juvie squad cars, as if any of the AWOLs will be stupid enough to try to get out through the main gate. They stop Nelson, and he flashes a stolen badge.
Orders to take this van to HQ. It's being impounded as evidence.
What, are you kidding me? The whole damn place is being impounded as evidence. They couldn't wait for a tow truck?
When can they wait for anything? The cop shakes his head.
Incredible!
And he waves Nelson through. As Nelson leaves the graveyard behind, he turns on the radio, surfs until he finds a song he knows, and sings with rare joy. Devan, his black market dealer, will pay a fortune, and the dollar signs Nelson now sees will soon be seen through the Akron AWOL's eyes. That's the real reward. Far more important than the cash. Nelson doesn't even remember what this kid's eyes are like, but it doesn't matter. Whatever their color, whatever their acuity, they'll be the last pair Nelson will ever need. They will be perfect. He's still thinking of Connor's eyes when he hears the high-pitched blast of a tranq pistol and feels a sudden sharp pain in his leg, then a second, then a third. His hands, suddenly lead-heavy, fall from the steering wheel, and with his last bit of strength, he forces his head to turn so he can see his attacker. Rising from behind him in the van is Lev, wearing a smile as big as the desert around them.
"Tranq by your own gun," Lev says. "How pathetic."
71. Lev. Nelson had used Lev to help him find Connor, and now Lev has returned the favor. With so many juvies and so many riot police, getting anyone out of the graveyard would be a miracle. And then Lev realized that, at least for the moment, Nelson was his greatest ally. Both Nelson and Lev had the same objective, get Connor away from the juvies and out of the graveyard alive. So Lev carried an unconscious Connor right into Nelson's path. Lev risked exposing his identity, but with so many kids running, and the only lights from headlights and spotlights, it was easy to keep his face in shadows, then drop Connor and run, letting Nelson do the hard work of getting Connor out. While Nelson carried Connor off, Lev raced ahead and slipped into his van, keeping low, hoping that Nelson would be distracted by the events around him and euphoric enough at his catch to never notice that Lev was hiding in the back seat. Now, half a mile from the graveyard, Nelson slumps in the driver's seat, unconscious, and Lev hurries to take the wheel, keeping the truck from flying off the road. Then, pushing Nelson aside, he stomps on the brakes and the van comes to a halt. Only one thing left to do. Leaving the van, Lev doubles back on foot to the gate. From his position on the floor of the van, he hadn't been able to see how many juvies were at the gate. Now, as he gets close, he sees there are only a handful. All the rest are in the battle zone. The scant chaparral of the desert doesn't provide enough cover to hide him, but he has to get closer. He told the kid at the gate to get Miracolina and take her someplace safe. The kid said he would do it, but Lev has to be sure. There's a squad car right in front of the spot where Miracolina had been, and a juvie cop leans against it, talking on his radio. The moment the juvie cop looks away, Lev darts behind the car, keeping low, and checks behind the dry bushes. She's not there. He breathes a silent sigh of relief, then turns and hurries back to the van. Once there, he pulls Nelson out and leaves him unconscious in a ditch. Then Lev does his best to drive the van down the narrow two-lane road, which is much different from driving a Jeep off-road across open desert.
"How stupid would it be," he thinks, "if after all this, Connor and I both die in a car accident because I don't know how to drive."
He can only thank God that the road is straight. For once, he's batting 1,000, and although he knows he may never see Miracolina again, and that she may, in the end, submit herself for tithing, he knows that he's done everything within his power to save her, to free her.
"Be safe, Miracolina,"
he says to himself, hoping that by saying it, he can make it true, never knowing that the kid at the gate was only interested in saving himself, and that Miracolina was still unconscious just a few feet away from where Lev was searching, because he didn't think to look in the back seat of the squad car. 72. Starkey.
Well, Starkey, what do we do now?
If you ask me one more time, I'll rip your freaking head off!
Bam storms away in frustration.
At least we got out of there!
Starkey yells after her.
We're probably the only ones who did!
Although it's not going to mean much if they crash. Kids sit in groups on the floor of the seatless cabin, some of them crying at the ordeal they've been put through and the friends left behind.
Suck it up!
He yells at them.
We're storks! We're better than that!
Then he holds up his crushed hand, which is now so swollen and purple it barely resembles a hand at all.
Do you see me crying?
This war wound, he realizes, has already become a symbol of his power and a talisman of respect. The whimpers subside, but not entirely. The truth is, in spite of the morphine swiped from the medical jet, his hand still aches too much to have patience for anything or anybody.
Where are we going?
Someone asks.
A better place,
Starkey says, then realizes that's what they say when you die. He storms to the cockpit and storks clear out of his way. Trey sits at the controls with no co-pilot, and Starkey begins with a threat.
If you as much as touch that radio...
Trace looks at him, disgusted, then back to the control panel.
Just because you're the one leading these kids, it doesn't mean I want them to be unwound. I haven't, nor will I notify anyone.
Good. Tell me the plan. Tell me what you schemed up with Connor.
Trace grips the controls to maintain stability as they hit a patch of turbulence. More whimpers from the cabin. Once the turbulence subsides, Trace says,
We'll be over Mexican airspace in a few minutes, which buys us time because our military can't pursue without permission, and theirs won't until they see us as a threat. Next, we fly within a mile of another jet headed north, switch signatures. When that other jet hits American airspace, they'll think it's us.
We can do that?
Trace doesn't even answer the question.
The plan was to double back into the U.S. and land in an abandoned airfield in the Anza Borrego Desert east of San Diego, but there's a problem with the landing gear.
Starkey already knows this. They all felt the collision as the plane smashed the truck in its path. Everyone heard something rip loose. There's no question that there's damage, but it's impossible to know how much. All they have is an idiot light on the control panel that says, Landing Gear Failure.
So what do we do about it?
We die.
Trace lets the thought linger for a moment, then says,
I can try to set us down in a body of water. I'm thinking the Salton Sea.
In Utah?
No, that's the Great Salt Lake, moron. The Salton Sea is a huge dead lake south of Palm Springs. There's a town there that's the asshole of the armpit of the world. You'd fit right in.
Starkey snarls at him, then decides he's not worth it.
How long?
I have to find a passing jet and do the signature switch first. Figure an hour and a half till we're there.
Fine. I'll tell the others.
He turns to go, then pauses at the cockpit door, looking back at Trace.
And if you call me moron one more time, I'll blow your brains out.
Trace turns to him and smiles.
Then you can land this plane, moron.
73. Risa. Risa sits in a network studio dressing room, staring at the monitor. The late-night news show on which she and Cam are about to appear has just reported some breaking news. A crackdown on a massive AWOL hideout in Arizona. None other than the airplane graveyard. Kids are already being shipped to harvest camps.
It is believed that these same AWOL unwinds are responsible for a rampage of violence in the city of Tucson,
says the anchorman.
The juvenile authority hopes this raid will allow the citizens of Tucson to rest easy once more.
How could this happen? After all the horrific things Risa has done for the past 2 months to prevent this raid, to keep Connor and Hayden and everyone there safe, the juvies raided anyway. Maybe it was always going to happen, and Roberta's bargain was a lie from the beginning. How could Risa have been so stupid as to trust anything that woman said? The assistant stage manager pokes his head in the door.
3 minutes, Miss Ward.
Risa never considered herself a violent girl. Sure, she's always been more than able to defend herself, but she was never the kind of girl to initiate or enjoy brutality. Yet in this moment, she knows she would kill Roberta if she had the means to do it. Then she realizes she doesn't have to. In less than 3 minutes, Risa will be broadcasting live to a national audience. She doesn't have to kill Roberta. She can unwind her. Bright, unnatural light. A TV studio with no audience. A well-known news personality in a suit and tie, looking smaller and older in person than he does on TV. 3 cameras. One on him, one on Risa, one on Cam. As they wait for the show to come back from commercial, news guy briefs them.
I'll be asking both of you questions. First about Risa's decision to support unwinding. Then about the process of rewinding that ostensibly led to Cam's birth, if you will. And finally, I'll ask about your relationship and how you two found each other. I know they're all questions you've been asked before, but I'm hoping you can give me something fresh.
Well, we'll certainly do our best,
Risa says, with a grin that's a little too pleasant. Cam leans over to her and whispers,
We should hold hands.
There's no wide shot, she points out. No one will see.
We should, anyway.
But this time Cam will not get his way. The stage manager counts down from 5. The red light on camera 1 comes on.
Welcome back, says news guy. Considering the current police action in Arizona, our guests tonight have a certain resonance, if you will. A militant AWOL turned unwinding advocate, and a young man who, were it not for unwinding, would not even exist. Risa Ward and Camu Compri.
A moment of pleasant welcomes, and he starts his questioning, as he promised, with Risa, but hits her with something designed to throw her off balance.
Miss Ward, as a former AWOL yourself, what's your take on the raid in Arizona? Do you support the unwinding of these runaways?
Nothing he asks can fluster her, because she already knows exactly what she's going to say. Risa turns to look right into camera 2, which has just come on.
I feel it's important that I set the record straight,
Risa begins.
I am not now, nor have I ever been, in favor of unwinding.
74. Roberta. Had Roberta been paying attention, things might have gone down differently, meaning they wouldn't have gone down at all. To her credit, her bargain with Risa was an honest, if intensely manipulative one. She made a few calls, pulled a few strings, and was able to confirm with the juvenile authority that there were no imminent raids planned on the airplane graveyard. Should that change, Roberta would be given ample warning, which meant ample time to pull further strings to prevent such a raid. Roberta has never been about deceit. She's about results. However, she has been so wrapped up in the media campaign to make Cam the darling of modern times, she's not aware of the homes set on fire in Tucson, and the brazen youth who set them, claiming to be the avenger of all unwound storks. Yes, the juvenile authority was supposed to notify Roberta of the raid through her associates at Proactive Citizenry, but like any spider-like organization, the fangs of Proactive Citizenry don't know what the spinneret is doing. Once the news hit the airwaves, of course, her phone began to ring her pocket off, but she's been too fed up with too many people wanting too much of her time to answer it. Thus, Roberta does not know about the raid until the interview with Risa and Cam begins, and by then, it's too late. Roberta sits in the green room, the studio's pleasant little ready room, replete with stale Danishes and weak coffee, watching a monitor that broadcasts from the studio down the hall. Her expression of horror could curdle the non-dairy creamer.
I am not now, nor have I ever been, in favor of unwinding, Risa says. Unwinding may be the single most evil act sanctioned by the human race.
The newsman, famous for being cool under fire, stammers for a moment.
But all those public service announcements you made...
They're lies. I was being blackmailed.
Roberta bursts out of the green room into the hall and storms toward the studio door. The red light is on. It's supposed to be a warning not to go in, since the cameras are live. But it's a warning she has no intention of heeding. In the corridor around her are a series of monitors broadcasting Reese's diatribe. Her face is on every screen, looking at Roberta from half a dozen different directions.
I was threatened and blackmailed by a group called Proactive Citizenry. Oh, they have lots of other names, like the Consortium of Concerned Taxpayers and the National Whole Health Society, but it's all smoke and mirrors.
Yes, I'm aware of Proactive Citizenry, the newsman says.
But isn't it a philanthropic group,
a charitable organization?
Charitable to whom?
Just as Roberta nears the stage door, she's intercepted by a security guard.
I'm sorry, ma'am, you can't go in right now.
Let me pass, or I promise you you'll be out of work by morning.
His response is to stand firm and call for backup, so Roberta heads for the control booth instead.
They claim to control the juvenile authority, Risa continues. They claim to control a lot of things. Maybe they do, and maybe they don't, but believe me, Proactive Citizenry has no one's interests at heart but its own.
The shot cuts to Cam, who looks dumbfounded, or just plain dumb. Then it goes back to the newsman.
So, your relationship with Camus is nothing but a publicity stunt, says Risa. A publicity stunt carefully planned by Proactive Citizenry to help Cam be accepted and adored.
Roberta bursts into the control booth, where an engineer works the editing bay, and the show's producer leans back in his chair, extremely pleased.
This is mint,
he tells his engineer.
The Princess of Unwinding bites the disembodied hand that feeds her. It doesn't get any better than this.
Stop the interview,
orders Roberta.
Stop it now or I will hold you and your network liable for everything she says.
The producer is unfazed.
Excuse me, who are you?
I'm her manager, and she is not authorized to say what she's saying.
Well, lady, if you don't like what your client has to say, that's not our problem.
Your viewers need to ask themselves this,
Risa says.
Who stands to benefit most from unwinding? Answer that question, and I think we'll know who's behind Proactive Citizenry.
Then the security guard comes up behind Roberta and manhandles her out the door. Roberta is relegated to the green room until the interview is over and they cut to commercial. The guard, still on intruder alert mode, won't let her pass.
I have orders to keep you out of the studio.
I am going to the restroom.
She pushes past him and bolts for the studio door. Both Risa and Cam are gone, and the next guests are being mic'd. Avoiding the guard, who Roberta knows is fully prepared to trank her, she turns down a side hallway to the dressing rooms. Risa's dressing room is empty, but Cam is in his. His coat and tie are strewn on the ground like he couldn't wait to peel out of them. He sits before the vanity with his head in his hands.
Did you hear what she said about me? Did you hear?
Where is she?
Head in the sand. Turtle in its shell. Leave me alone.
Focus, Cam. She was on the stage with you. Where did she go?
She ran. She said it was over. That she was history. And she ran down the emergency stairs.
She will be history when I'm through with her.
Roberta takes the emergency stairs down. They're on the second floor, and the only place for Risa to go is out into the parking lot, which is mostly empty at this time of night. She can't have had more than a 15-second lead, but she's nowhere to be seen. The only person around is their driver, who leans against his limo, eating a sandwich.
Did you see her?
Roberta asks.
See who?
He answers. And Roberta's phone starts ringing like it will never stop. 75. Cam. Roberta returns from her unsuccessful search for Risa. Cam meets her in the green room, where two security guards now wait, eager to escort Roberta out. She's on the phone, already in the throes of damage control.
Antarctica, Cam says. I should have said something out there, but I froze.
What's done is done,
she says, then growls at a dropped call.
Let's get out of here.
I'll meet you at the car,
Cam tells her.
My stuff's still in the dressing room.
The guards solemnly escort Roberta out of the building, and Cam goes back to the dressing room. He puts on his sports coat and carefully rolls up his tie, putting it in his pocket. Then, when he's sure Roberta has left the building, he says,
"It's okay. She's gone."
The closet door opens, and Risa steps out.
"Thank you, Cam."
Cam shrugs.
"She deserved it."
He turns to look at her. She's breathing rapidly, as if she's been running, but he knows she's only been running in her head.
"Will they all be unwound? Your AWOL friends?"
"Not right away," she tells him. "But yes, they will be."
"I'm sorry."
"It's not your fault."
Although she doesn't look at him when she says it, like maybe she thinks it somehow is, like his very existence makes him guilty.
"I can't help what I am,"
he tells her.
"I know, but today you showed me you can help what you do."
And then she leans forward and kisses him on the cheek. He feels it like an electric shock in all the seams of his face. She turns to go, but he can't let her. Not yet. Not without saying,
"I love you, Risa."
She glances back at him and offers nothing more than an apologetic smile.
"Goodbye, Cam."
And she's gone. It's only after she leaves that the anger begins to rise in him. Not just a spike, but an eruption, and there's nowhere for it to go. He takes the chair and hurls it against the vanity mirror, smashing it. He hurls everything that's breakable against the walls, and doesn't stop until the security guards burst in on him. It takes 3 guards to restrain him, but still he's stronger. He has the best of the best in him, every muscle group, every synaptic reflex. He tears free from the guards, bolts down the emergency exit stairs, and meets Roberta in the limo.
"What took you so long?"
"Solitude," he says. "I needed some time alone."
"It's all right, Cam,"
she tells him as they drive away.
"We'll get past this."
"Yes, I know we will."
But he keeps his true thoughts to himself. Cam will never accept Risa's goodbye. He will not let her disappear from his life. He will do whatever it takes to have her, to hold her, to keep her. He has all of Roberta's resources at his fingertips to get what he wants, and he's going to use them. Roberta smiles at him reassuringly between phone calls, and he smiles back. For now, Cam will play the game. He'll be the good, rewound boy Roberta wants him to be. But from this moment on, he has a new agenda. He will make Risa's dream come true and take down proactive citizenry piece by bloody piece. And then she will have no choice but to love him. Part 7. Landings. Our country is challenged at home and abroad. It is our will that is being tried, and not our strength. President Johnson, on Vietnam and the School Campus War Protests, 1968. I have every faith that this devastating national conflict shall be resolved, and that the accord between both sides shall also serve as an ultimate solution to the feral teenage problem. But until that glorious day, I am instituting an 8 p.m. curfew for anyone under the age of 18. President Moss, on the Heartland War, 2 weeks prior to his assassination by militant New Jersey separatists. 76. Dreamliner. In Southern California, far south of the glitz of Hollywood and far east of the suburban sprawl of San Diego, lies an inland sea as forgotten and as unloved as a state ward AWOL or a harvest camp stork. Hundreds of thousands of years ago, it was the northern reach of the Sea of Cortez, before that sea even had a name. But now it's little more than a giant landlocked salt lake, slowly drying into desert, too saline for vertebrate life. Its fish have all died. Their bones cover the shores like gravel. At 10 minutes to midnight, a plane once heralded as the dream of aviation before it was replaced by newer dreams, descends toward the Salton Sea. It is flown by a young military pilot with far more confidence than experience. Barely clearing the mountains around the lake, the jet comes in for what airlines ridiculously call a water landing. it does not go well. 77. Starkey. No seat belts. No seats. No way to brace themselves for a crash landing.
Lock your elbows together. Hook your legs around each other,
Starkey tells them.
We'll be one another's seat belts.
The storks obey, huddling, locking limbs, turning themselves into a tangled colony of flesh and bone. Sitting on the floorboards, no one can see out the windows to know how close the lake is. But then Trace comes on the intercom.
About 20 seconds,
he says. Then the angle of their descent changes as he pulls up the nose of the jet.
See on the other side,
Starkey says, then realizes once more that it's something you say when you're about to die. Starkey counts down the last 20 seconds in his head, but nothing happens. Was he counting too fast? Did Trace misjudge? If this is 20 seconds, then they're the longest of his life. Then it finally comes, a jarring jolt, followed by calm.
Was that it?
Someone says.
Is it over?
There's another jolt, then another and another, each one coming closer together, and Starkey realizes the plane is skimming like a stone. On the fifth skim, a wing dips, acting like a rudder that pivots the plane to a diagonal, and suddenly it's the end of the world. The Dreamliner begins to flip end over end, turning cartwheels against the unforgiving surface of the lake. Inside, the mob of kids is launched from the floorboards and pulled apart by centrifugal force, thrown in two separate clusters to either end of the main cabin. The hooking of arms actually saves many of them, as they're cushioned by the bodies around them. But those on the outside of the tumbling crush of kids, those acting as the cushions, become the sacrifices. Many of them are killed as they're slammed against the hard surfaces of the Dreamliner. The cache of weapons, which had been stowed in the overhead compartments, flies free as well, as those compartments tear loose and burst open. Pistols and rifles and machine guns and grenades become ballistic, creating casualties without ever having to go off. Wrapped in the forward twist of bodies, Starkey feels his head hit something hard, leaving a gash on his forehead. But that's nothing compared to the exploding pain in his battered hand. Finally, the tumbling jet comes to rest. The cries and wails sound like silence compared to the noise of the crash. Then somewhere toward the back of the cabin there's an explosion, a grenade that lost its pin. It blows a hole in the side of the jet, and water begins to pour in. That's when the electrical system fails, and they're plunged into darkness.
Over here!
Bam calls. She pulls a huge lever and opens the cabin's front port side door. A life raft automatically inflates and detaches, then drops to the water. And with a
sayonara,
Bam leaps right out after it. Starkey's instinct is to get out now, but if he's going to be seen as the protector of the storks, then he must be their protector in action, not just words. He waits, shooing kids out the door, making it clear he is not the first one out, but neither does he plan on being the last. Farther back in the foundering jet, kids pull open wing exits and a midship hatch, but only on the left side. On the right, a slick of jet fuel has ignited in the water and burns beyond the windows.
The weapons!
Starkey shouts.
Take the weapons! We still have to defend ourselves!
And so kids pick up any and all weapons they can find, throwing them out onto the rafts before jumping out themselves. The fire outside provides enough light for Starkey to see to the far recesses of the main cabin, and he wishes he hadn't looked. The dead are everywhere. Blood is smeared on every surface, sticky and thick. But there are more living than dead, and more kids running than crawling. Starkey determines right then and there to save only those who can make it out on their own. The critically injured are just liabilities. The angle of the floor is quickly changed as the jet begins to sink tail first. The rear cabin is already flooded, and the water level rises in a steady, relentless surge past the central bulkhead. Then Starkey hears a muffled voice from the front of the jet.
I need help here!
Starkey makes his way to the cockpit door and pulls it open. The windshield is shattered, and the entire cockpit is a mess of smashed gauges, open panels, and exposed wires. The pilot's chair has jammed forward, and Trace is pinned. which leaves Starkey in an interesting position.
Starkey,
says Trace, relieved.
I need you to pull me out of here. I can't do it by myself.
Yes, that's a problem, Starkey says. But is it his problem? They needed Trace to get them this far, but they don't need a pilot anymore. And didn't Trace already threaten to kill him? If Trace survives, from this moment on he'll be nothing but a threat, and a dangerous one at that.
I never had the guts to try the Great Water Escape, says Starkey. It killed Houdini, but I'm sure it'll be easy for a big buff like you.
Then he backs out of the cockpit and closes the door.
Starkey!
Trace yells.
Starkey, you son of a bitch!
But Starkey's decision is final, and as he returns to the main hatch, Trace's muffled voice is drowned out by the sounds of panicking storks. There are about a dozen kids left, the slow ones, the injured ones, the ones afraid to jump because they can't swim.
What's that awful smell?
One of them whines.
What is that out there?
He's right. There's a stench to this lake, like a fish tank left to putrefy. But it's the least of their problems. Water's already pooling at their feet, and the floor is at a 30-degree tilt. Starkey pushes past the lingering kids.
Jump or drown! You got no other choice, and I'm not waiting for stragglers!
Then he hurls himself out the door and into the foul-smelling brine of the Salton Sea. 78. Trace. Trace's calls for help go unanswered, and in furious frustration he pounds the console and bucks in the chair, but it doesn't give. He's so tightly wedged in by the accordioned cockpit, not even a buff of his strength can get out. He forces himself to calm down and review his options. All he can hear now are the diminishing moans and wails of kids too injured to escape, and of course, the relentless rush of water. That's when he realizes there are no options left to him anymore. Starkey made certain of that. The lake begins to pour in through the broken cockpit window so quickly there's no time to prepare himself. Trace cranes his neck, trying to keep his head above water as long as he can. Then he takes one deep gulp of air, holds it, and he's underwater. Suddenly there's silence all around him except for the metallic complaints of the sinking jet. His body burns through the last of its oxygen. Then, resigned to his fate, Trace releases his final breath. It bubbles away from him in the darkness, and his body gets to the business of drowning. It's as awful as he ever imagined it might be, but he knows it won't last long. 5 seconds. 10. Then the injustice of it all doesn't seem to matter anymore. As the last of his consciousness filters away, Trace holds on to the hope that his choice to fight on the side of the AWOLs instead of the juvenile authority will be enough to pay his passage to a truly better place. 79. Starkey. The water tastes like rubber and rot, and is neither warm nor cold, but tepid, like tea left to steep an hour too long. The last of the plane disappears beneath the surface, leaving nothing but white water bubbling up through the brine and the fuel slick, which has almost burned itself out. Starkey looks around to see kids in the water, kids on rafts, and kids who've drifted too far away to see it all, calling out for help. There's a deserted shore just a few hundred yards away. Trace, rest his soul, knew enough to bring them down near the unpopulated side of the huge lake. Even so, people will have seen the crash and will come to investigate. They have to get away from the scene as quickly as possible. The attention of the locals is the last thing they need.
This way!
Starkey tells them and starts swimming, pulling himself forward with his good hand. The kids in rafts paddle, the kids in the water swim, and in a few minutes they're pulling themselves out of the fetid water onto a spongy shore of pulverized fish bones. Starkey sets Bam to do a head count, and she comes back with 128. They lost 41 in the crash. Around him, the survivors try to tally exactly who is missing, which just makes Starkey angry. Sitting here will do nothing but get them captured. He knows he's cunning enough to make it on his own, Somehow he's got to extend his survival smarts to all of them.
Everybody up! We can't waste our time licking our wounds and mourning the dead. We gotta get out of here.
Where do you suggest we go? Asks Bam.
Right now, anywhere but here.
Starkey knows he needs to give these kids direction and purpose. Now that they're free from the holding pen of the graveyard, their priorities need to change. Connor might have been happy to just keep kids alive, but Starkey has to make this about more than just survival. Under his leadership, his storks can be a force to be reckoned with. He goes to the nearest kids nursing their exhaustion and lifts them to their feet by their collars.
Let's move! We'll rest when we're safe!
When will we ever be safe?
Someone asks. Starkey doesn't answer because he knows they'll probably never be. But that's all right. They've been complacent for too long. Being on the edge will keep them sharp and focused. As the storks all gather their strength for an uncertain journey on foot, Starkey searches through them until he finds Jivan, relieved that he's one of the survivors.
Jeeves, we'll need the same type of setup you had in the comm bomb, but mobile. I need you to be our eyes and ears and gather all the intelligence you can from the juvenile authority.
Jivan just shakes his head in panicked disbelief.
That was all high-end military software. We don't have it anymore. We don't even have a computer.
We'll commandeer as many computers as you need, Starkey tells him, and you'll make it work.
Jivan nods nervously.
Yes, sir.
Even before they leave the shore, Starkey's grand plan begins to take shape. He will step up the campaign of vengeance he began in Tucson. Only this time, it won't just be a handful of avenging storks. It will be all of them. A guerrilla army 128 strong, heaping punishment on anyone who would unwind a stork. Their numbers will grow with every stork they rescue. He doesn't doubt that in time they could take down entire harvest camps. And then the Akron AWOL will be nothing but a sorry footnote beneath his own legacy. Drawing strength from his powerful vision, Starkey leads them into the mountains east of the Salton Sea. His first trick will be to make them all disappear, but that's only the beginning. From this moment on, there will be no end to the magic. 80. Miracolina. Miracolina's head is spinning as she awakes. That's how she knows she's been tranked. This is the fourth time she's been tranked. She knows the drill by now. Memories of the events leading up to it come back, but slowly and not in order. She suppresses the nausea and sets to the task of determining her current circumstances and defragging her mind. She's moving. She's in a vehicle. She was traveling with Lev. Is she in the back of a pickup? No. Is she in the baggage compartment of a bus? No. It's night. She's in the back seat of a car. Is Lev with her? No. They weren't in a vehicle at the end, were they? They were walking, by a fence, toward an old Air Force base. Is there more? There must be, but try as she might, she can't remember anything after walking toward the gate. Although she knows it will make her feel as if her brain wants to escape through her ears, she sits up. There's a thick glass barrier between her and the front seat. A police car? Yes, two juvie cops are in the front seat. This should be good news for her. It means that she's finally surfaced out of the underworld that Lev has dragged her through. It doesn't feel good at all, though, and it's more than just the tranks. That she's in a squad car doesn't bode well for Lev, and she can no longer deny that she cares about what happens to him in spite of herself. The juvie cop at the wheel glances in his rearview mirror, catching her gaze.
"Well, look who's awake," he says pleasantly.
Can you tell me what happened?
The sound of her own voice makes her head pound.
Police action at the aircraft salvage yard, he says. But you already know that, don't you?
No, I was tranked outside the gate.
And then she adds,
I was out for a walk.
Which is a stupid thing to say, considering how isolated that road is.
We know who you are, Miracolina.
The cop riding shotgun says. The news makes her have to lie back down on the sticky leather of the back seat, but she leans the wrong way and ends up slumped against the door.
he told you?
She asks. She can't imagine Lev voluntarily giving her name to the juvies.
No one told us,
he says, and holds up a small electronic device.
DNA tester. Standard issue for juvie cops since Happy Jack.
I'd like to know what she's talking about,
says the cop driving. Well, if they don't know, she's not going to tell them. If Lev hasn't been caught, then he wasn't with her when she was. But would he just leave her? Lev is such a mixed bag of contradicting ethics, she can't be sure. But no, that's a lie. The kind of lie she used to tell herself just to demonize him. Deep down, she knows he wouldn't leave her voluntarily. If he did, he had no choice. Still, there's no telling whether he's free or has been captured.
What I want to know, asks the cop riding shotgun, is how you wound up outside the gate and not inside like the rest of them.
Miracolina decides to tell them an edited version of the truth, since they're not going to believe it anyway.
I escaped from a parts pirate with a friend,
she tells them.
We were looking for a place of safety.
The two cops look to each other.
So you had no idea that the airplane graveyard was an AWOL stronghold?
We were just told to go there, that we would be safe from the parts pirates.
Who told you?
Some guy,
she says, which sounds like something any kid would say, and effectively throws a wet rag over the question.
How'd you get tranked?
When she doesn't answer, the driver looks at his partner and says,
Probably a trigger-happy rookie.
His partner just shrugs.
Well, you're here, and you're safe. Was your friend a tithe, too?
Miracolina has to suppress a smile.
Yes,
she says.
He was.
She's pleased she can lie to them in complete honesty, because after all, it is the best policy.
Well, no tithes turn themselves in, Shotgun says. Perhaps he got hauled off with the rest.
The rest?
Like we said, police action. Rounded up a huge nest AWOLs, a few hundred at least.
Again, something that once would have been good news for Miracolina. Justice prevailing, order restored, now brings her nothing but melancholy.
Any bigwigs brought in?
She asks, knowing that if Lev or his friend, the Akron AWOL, were caught, it would be big news. They'd all know.
No such thing as a bigwig AWOL, sweetie. They're all non-entities. Otherwise, they wouldn't be where they are.
Again, she sighs in relief, and the cops assume her sigh is exhaustion from the tranquilizers.
Lie back down, honey. You got nothing to worry about. The Bart's pirates can't get you now.
But she stays upright, not wanting to slip into a post-trank stupor. There's something off about the way they're treating her. After all, she is an unwind with a questionable story, and even though she's a tithe, she's never known juvies to be so nice to kids about to be unwound. As they said, they see unwinds as non-entities. You don't call non-entities honey and sweetie. As they pull into the local juvie headquarters, she begins to wonder what the process is now.
I was supposed to go to Wood Hollow Harvest Camp,
she tells them.
Will I still go there, or to a camp in Arizona?
Neither,
the driver says.
Excuse me?
He parks the car and turns to her.
From what I understand, your parents never actually signed the unwind order.
That leaves Miracolina speechless. They never signed it. Now she remembers them telling her that as she stood at the door. But she told them it was her choice to go, and she got into the van anyway.
Even if you'd made it to Wood Hollow, you would have just been sent home once they double-checked the paperwork. Can't unwind without an order.
She laughs at the irony of it. All this time, fighting to finally be tithed, and not only won't it happen, but it was never going to happen. She wants to be angry, but how can she fault her parents for loving her too much to let her go? She wonders how things would have been different if she had known. Would she still have taken the journey west with Lev after escaping from the parts pirate? Would she have stayed with him long enough to forgive him, granting him that absolution he so desperately needed? To her amazement, the answer is no. Had she known she'd never be tithed, that call she made to her parents wouldn't have just been a message that she was alive. It would have been a plea to come and get her. she would have let Lev finish his journey alone, solitary and unforgiven.
"I know how tithes are," says the shotgun cop sympathetically. "If it's what you really want, you can take it up with your parents when they get here."
And although it is what she wants, she's coming to terms with the disappointment of staying whole.
"Thank you,"
she says.
"Thank you so much."
But it's not them she's thanking. Either things happen for a reason or they happen for no reason at all. Either one's life is a thread in a glorious tapestry, or humanity is just a hopelessly tangled knot. Miracolina has always believed in the tapestry, and now she feels blessed to have had a glimpse of its smallest corner. Now she knows her desire to be tithed was not there to leave her in a divided state. It was there to propel her into the right place at the right time, to have a hand in the redemption of the boy who would blow himself up. Who would have thought that the singular whole of her forgiveness was a more valuable gift than 100 of her parts? So she will return into the arms of her wildly emotional parents and will live the life they dream for her until she can find her own dream. She had no tithing party, but right now she resolves that she will have herself a grand celebration someday, perhaps a sweet 16. And she will find Lev, wherever in the world he is, ask him to attend, and refuse to take no for an answer, and then, finally, she will dance with him. 81. Hayden. To the best of Hayden's knowledge, they're the last ones left. There are 14 others in the comm bomb with him, all kids from the various communication shifts, who put more faith in him than in anyone else, which shocks Hayden. He had no idea there was anyone who looked up to him. One kid is noticeably absent. Before power was cut to the cameras, Hayden saw Javon getting into the Dreamliner with the other storks, his arms packed with pilfered weapons. Connor had stopped responding in the middle of the battle, and the juvies had, one by one, taken out the power generators, plunging the comm bomb and every other jet into darkness. By midnight, it's over. Through the windows of the comm bomb, Hayden can see the heavy transports, the battering ram, the riot trucks, and most of the juvie squad cars pulling out. Mission accomplished. Hayden thinks that maybe they've been forgotten, that they can sit it out for a few more hours, then make a break for freedom. But the juvenile authority is smarter than that.
"We know you're in there!"
they shout through a bullhorn.
"Come out, and we promise no one will get hurt!"
"What do we do?"
the kids around him ask.
"Nothing,"
Hayden says.
"We do nothing."
Being that the comm bomb was the communications center and brain of the graveyard, it's one of the few crafts with all its outer doors in place and in working order. It's also one of the few crafts that can only be opened from the inside. When the battle began, Hayden had sealed the airtight hatch, leaving them as self-contained and cut off as a submarine. Their only defense is their isolation and a submachine gun Connor insisted that Hayden have. He doesn't even know how to fire the thing.
"You're in a hopeless situation,"
the juvies yell through their bullhorn.
"You'll only make matters worse for yourselves."
"What could be worse than all of us getting unwound?"
Lisbeth asks. Then Tad, who from the very beginning has been hanging close to Hayden as if they're joined at the hip, says,
"It won't unwind you, Hayden. You're 17.
"Details, details," Hayden says. "Don't bother me with details."
"They'll storm us,"
warns Nassim.
"I've seen it on TV. They'll blow off the door and gas us, and a SWAT team will drag us out."
The others look nervously to Hayden to see what he'll say.
"The riot police have already left," Hayden points out. "We're not important enough to storm. We're just cleanup. I'll bet they just left the fat, stupid juvies to wait for us."
And the kids laugh. He's glad that they can still laugh. Regardless of IQ and body mass, the juvies aren't going away.
"All right,"
they announce.
"We can wait as long as you can."
And they do. At dawn, they're still there, just 3 squad cars and a small gray transport van. The media, which the cops held back through the raid, are now camped out just 50 yards away, their antennas and satellite dishes high. Hayden and his holdout holies have spent the night dozing on and off. Now the sight of the media gives some of them a surreal sort of hope.
If we go out there,
Tad says,
we'll be on the news. Our parents will see us.